This is an extraordinary moment in the career of Eddie Redmayne. While starring in the film My Week with Marilyn and on television in Birdsong, the adaptation of Sebastian Faulkes' first World War novel, he's been playing Richard II in Michael Grandage's final production at the Donmar, for which last week he won the Critics' Circle Award for Best Shakespearean Performance of 2011. It's 10 years since, as a Cambridge student, he played Violet, Mark Rylance's Olivia, in the Globe's 400th anniversary production of Twelfth Night, presented at Middle Temple Hall. Since then, he's acted with some of Hollywood's greats and won several awards for stage performances, notably as a newcomer for his intense portrayal of a troubled gay teenager in The Goat or Who is Sylvia at the Almeida, and for Red as Mark Rothko's assistant Ken. That production began at the Donmar and delivered him a Tony on Broadway. Well, before he sets off to prepare his singing voice for the role of Marius in the film of Les Miserables, Eddie Redmayne is fitting in a chat with Theatre Voice and is with me, Heather Neal, now in the auditorium, in the stalls at the Donmar, sitting right in the middle of the, almost, of this wonderful gilded set for Richard II, before he gets ready to take the stage again as Shakespeare's most theatrical king. Well, this is the first Shakespeare since Viola. So what was it like playing opposite Mark Rylance? And did that give you a grounding you can still draw on?
I had the most, I think, starting, it was actually really my professional career, starting with Mark. It was actually at the Middle Temple Hall, yes, where it was commissioned for, but we rehearsed at the Globe and used all the Globe's sort of facilities. And that's voice coaching, verse coaching. And I hadn't trained. As you said, I was at university at the time. So in some ways it was, I always think that was, in many ways, my training. They have a wonderful, and headed by Mark, they had a wonderful setup there. And so it was an amazing way to start. And I was suitably green that I didn't know a huge amount. I hadn't seen a massive amount of theatre. And so I suppose the undertaking, if I look back on it now, would have been quite intimidating. But I was sort of arrogance or ignorance of youth meant that I wasn't so intimidated by it.
No, it was splendid, I remember. But you had been on stage before, and you weren't you in Oliver?
That is true. I was, when I was about 11 years old, I played Workhouse Boy number 14/15 in a production of Oliver with Jonathan Pryce, and it was directed by Sam Mendes. I think I was in about the third cast. In fact, Ashley, it's hilarious how it pops up in your life, the amount of actors who were also in Oliver. So Ashley, who plays O'Merle in Richard II, was also in Oliver. Lots of sort of friends of mine who are singer-songwriters were all in Oliver. When I was auditioning for Les Miserables, made Cameron McIntosh aware of the fact that actually he had given me my first ever job. But certainly when I had my first day's rehearsal, I remember for The Goat with Jonathan Pryce, yeah. I remember saying to him, actually, John, we've worked together before. And he was like, really? And I was like, yeah, I was in Oliver. And he was like, what were you, Oliver, Dodger? Because I think he had several, you know, kids casts. And I was like, no, I was Workhouse Boy number 14/Book Boy. I had one line and I treasured that line. I remember it very clearly. Books you order from the bookseller, sir. Yeah.
But it must have been in your mind to go on stage quite early then. You were a choral scholar, though, weren't you?
I was a choral scholar at Cambridge, yeah. I always enjoyed music and acting at school. I had amazing teachers throughout my teens who were really inspiring actors who had decided to teach. And so I'd always loved it, and in a recreational way, and I'd had that little glimpse of it, I suppose, as a kid doing Oliver, and loved it, been totally sort of seduced by that world. So yeah, it was always something I was passionate about, but I didn't know whether it was a reality, really. I didn't know whether one could do it as a living.
Yeah, it's quite different when you're still at school. Well, you've also worked with Michael Grandage before, because you've been here in Hecuba and in Red. So, but this must be a bit more of a challenge. I mean, it's your first Shakespeare since Viola, isn't it? Mm. And it's a difficult play. It's all in verse.
Yeah.
So how did you do special preparation for the verse?
What was my preparation for this? The first thing that happened was Michael offered it to me, and I had such an amazing experience on Red. Had a wonderful time with Jonathan Kent doing Hecuba here. Have always loved the Donmar. Found it a sort of really you know, all actors talk about it, but it's an exceptional space to play. And so I was intimidated by the prospect, but if Michael had faith in me to do it, then I was excited by that prospect. And I remember, it's funny, actually sitting in the auditorium with you now, because I remember about 7 months before we started rehearsal, we came here, and with Richard, the designer, Michael and I had a discussion about the set and all these, and it was so exciting seeing all the model boxes and the ideas. And it got to a point where I said to Michael, look, Michael, this is all very, we were looking at costumes, this is all very well, but I should start saying some Shakespeare aloud to you in case you need to fire me, because I hadn't done it since, you know, for 10 years. And it was interesting, that experience, because we started working on just through one of them, I suppose, the monologues or a chunk of text, and it was rusty and ropey. And but then after a sort of hour of playing, we found something, and I wanted to make sure that he hadn't taken a sort of blind risk, and I knew it was his last production. And but as far as approaching the verse is concerned, he was Michael's very rigorous with diction and clarity, and often he knows that people come to the Domar and think it's a very intimate space, but actually it is bigger than you think to reach right up into the corners. So what I have found through the run is this thing of absolute clarity of diction and projection. But then if you feel like you've got an audience, if you feel like they are listening, and that's a sensitive kind of interaction, that, but then there are moments when you can pull it, provided you're being clear, you can pull it right down to a sort of bare whisper, but that depends on the night and depends on your relationship with an audience. But so we had a wonderful man known as the Prof, who came and helped us with I suppose the text itself and any questions we had on that.
And who was that?
Wasn't
Russell Jackson?
It was, yes, absolutely. Yes,
who wrote in the programme.
He wrote in the programme. And Russell has been worked with Michael many times before, and he's an incredibly kind man. And actually, we had a session together, a really lovely session early on, in which it wasn't, you know, just talking through moments of the verse and basically reaffirming the rules in order that you could. My opinion with Shakespeare is you absolutely have to know what the text is telling you in order to then, if you want to break those rules, to break them with the knowledge of that. But the fortunate thing for me was coming to the text kind of quite fresh. I didn't know it, and so I had no preconceptions of it, and again through ignorance. And I think that was quite good, because it meant that I wasn't, other than I've been studying How I May Compare This Prison, which looked so sort of damn huge on the page that I assumed it was quite a biggie. Other than that, I was ignorant enough to not be that overwhelmed by it.
Well, perhaps we should mention that you were actually studying history of art at Cambridge. You weren't an English literature scholar.
Yeah, yeah.
But, however, I'm sure you did agree quite a lot of Shakespeare. And perhaps we should also mention that Richard Kent is the name of the designer, because it's a rather fantastic
set. It's a beautiful set. And he is a brilliantly talented man.
And now, you, as a history of art scholar, you probably had seen the pictures, which include Richard, because he had an amazing portrait painted of him,
Absolutely.
Didn't he? Which is in Westminster Abbey.
It is in Westminster,
and
yeah.
I wonder if you're sort of recreating that at the very beginning of the play.
Yes, I mean, we went and looked at the portraits and the diptych at the National,
the Wilton
diptych, and I mean, one of the most important themes that was absolutely, which Michael was keen to project, and I absolutely agree with, is this notion of the divine right of monarchy that plays throughout the play, because it seems to be that is the thing that he clings on to as Richard, as all the chaos is happening around him. He absolutely believes that this that it was God's decision to make him king, and so we needed to set it in a period in which a contemporary audience can't relate to that perhaps. And so that's where the idea, and I think certainly through the diptych and the painting at Westminster Abbey, there was a sense of this faded, this sort of guild and maybe a sort of an indulgence that was falling apart at the seams slightly. And that was something that Richard played with. And as far as the costumes were concerned, we liked this idea again of there was a dandy quality to Richard, and he had great interest. There's talk in the play of fashions being buzzed into his ears from Italy, and so I like this idea. I'd done a film called The Golden Age, a sequel to Elizabeth with Kate Blanchett, and I remember her walking around a room with these huge dresses. And it would empower a room because she would take up a lot of space. And so we like this idea of because of this sort of perhaps a feat quality to him, but that there was a strength but also a fluidity to it. Mm. So that's where I suppose the first white, it's like a sort of coat dress, comes from.
Yeah. How long do you sit there holding yourself?
I sit there for about 15, 20 minutes.
Yes. And you seem not to blink almost.
Well, it's a blessing and a curse. It came about during rehearsal because Michael Hadley, who plays John Gaunt, had read a piece of research in which when Richard was trying to reassert his majesty, he would sit in the Palace of Westminster and his court would be in presence, and if he looked at one of them, they'd have to get down on their knees.
Yes.
And so he, so that idea of him sitting there was an interesting one as the audience came in. Yes. I think it has transferred its meaning to something symbolic of it, us kind of depicting the stature of that painting, the portrait, which was the first
real representation, wasn't it?
As opposed to just a
representation
almost
of monarchy,
exactly,
as a person.
But there is something almost icon-like. There's something almost religious in that posture, that he almost starts as demigod, and then that descent is into believing himself as demigod.
Yes.
And
Well, you mentioned Kate Blanchett playing Elizabeth just now. She, of course, was also very keen on her image. Mm. But this was a dangerous play in her time, wasn't it?
Mm.
And in fact, the deposition scene was never printed during her lifetime.
Yeah. And it was used by the Earl of Essex.
Essex,
he commissioned it. Yeah. I mean, what's very interesting to me is the first way I ever came into contact with Richard II was Tom Hooper directed a television miniseries of Elizabeth I with Helen Mirren, in which I played the Earl of Southampton, who was the Earl of Essex's sort of counterpart.
Mm.
And there was a scene in that, which was actually cut from the film, in which the Earl of Essex and his men watched a production of Richard II, which then was put on by the Earl of Essex, or commissioned by the Earl of Essex, to catalyse this advance and this staged coup. So
it was just the day before, wasn't it?
It was the day before, and so that was the first time I had ever heard done. So it was. That is interesting, and I think that idea of. I mean, we were talking about this in the dressing room the other day about how bold a statement that is, even without the deposition scene. I mean, it's still, and what the Queen's reaction would have been to that. But
it's because it was the 1590s; she was already too old, obviously, to marry and have her own child. Mm. So people were worried about
what was absolutely, and this idea of people buzzing in information into her ears. And
Well, as you say, you start off. I mean, in your preparation for the character, are you thinking of him as really as certain of himself, or is he having to convince himself all the time of his actual authority? Because he's very young. I mean, he actually became king when he was only about 9 or 10, didn't he?
Yeah.
And we see him obviously near the end of his reign, but he's still a young man.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, there are so many. It's interesting when you do a play like this because, of course, you look at the historical reference, but then it's a bit like doing an adaptation like a Birdsong. You read the book, or I did Tess of the D'Urbervilles for you, and the book is, of course, your source. But there comes a point where you have both the script and the book, and you keep associating the two and trying to glean as much as you can from the original source. Mm. But there comes a point where you have to play the script rather than the book.
Yes, I was going to ask you that.
And that's the same with Richard II, I mean, in the sense that Isabel, his queen, is a conflation of sort of two wives. In fact, Isabel he married when she was 6 years old or something. And so what I take from it, I suppose, is this idea that Richard had been a young king, incredibly young king. He had then had to deal with a peasants' revolt aged 14. So he'd been basically brought up by these uncles. And now he is growing older. There must have been a weird transfer moment between, you know, as any adolescent has with a figure of authority. And at what point you, when you try to put your own mark on things, and clearly that happened with Richard. And but in some ways he was this child star. He had been very successful with the Peasants' Revolt, and so
he was very brave, wasn't he?
Absolutely. But then I always sit there going, he was 14. So yes. How much can he have actually been doing himself? And how much? But he absolutely lived in this gilded sort of existence of clearly being slightly out of touch with what the country thought of him. But at this point, I feel like he is trying to push down and affirm this majesty by dealing with these uncles who have been so influential and at moments irritating. But I think he's not competent. I mean, I don't believe that. I think there is certainly, in my take on Richard II, is even from the outset, that first scene in which this sort of horrific thing is being brought before his eyes, this court case between Mowbray and Bolingbroke. People say it's Richard II is a lot of people's favourite plays. A lot of people can't get the first scene because it's you're straight into this quite complicated scenario. And I think one of the reasons it's not more performed as a play is because the backstory at the first scene about Gloucester's death and Richard probably having had Mowbray kill Gloucester, but it's so difficult to pick all that nuance up. So in the first scene, whilst he's playing at being in charge, and there's a lot going underneath of complete nervousness, of going, the entire country knows that King Richard has had his uncle killed, and yet no one has had the sort of strength to bring it up in front of him, and Mowbray is doing this in front of his eyes. And so I always think that there's a, you know, telling that story is very tricky. But in that first scene, he is trying to demonstrate authority whilst actually not being competent of it. And certainly this subconscious urge to will the crown away, I think, is there almost from the outset.
Do you? I in other productions, he has been played as a bit camp and a bit almost funny sometimes. I mean, and so that you get to the deposition scene, and it's a sort of, you know, it's a hissy fit, really. It's a sort of he's being a spoiled boy. Where, did you have to bear that in mind and avoid it? I mean, was the sort of campness something you avoided?
No, I talked to. I mean, I know he's often been played as gay as well. There are references to that as
Shakespeare's answer to Edward II,
second, exactly, and to what his sexuality was. I mean, I had a discussion with Michael about that straight off, and that wasn't something that. I mean, I think that he has a sort of flamboyance I didn't think of him as a gay king. In fact, I wanted that scene with. I wanted. It was one of the real challenges of this play was to make the parting scene with the Queen effective, even when there's only they have one line of contact in the play. I think it is, in which he goes, "Come on, my Queen, tomorrow must we part," and so I think. I didn't have any reference to. I mean, I had seen Kevin Spacey's fantastic production, but other than that, I didn't really have anything that I was associating it with, and I was just trying to find a through line to a character who is so changeable, and to try and work out where those changes are and what a continuity to that was, and through that, definitely humour but also weird mixtures of utter confidence and complete lack of self-confidence.
Yes, you know. And then of course he's very callous at the death of Gaunt. Was that something he'd been planning? He needed the money, of course, to
absolutely.
To, I mean, I don't know whether to Ireland.
Yes, I mean, I think that the relationship that certainly we talked about in the piece is that Gaunt has been one of the uncles that has really been pushed, and in the same way, something that we talked about completely outside of the perhaps the historical truth or the script was this idea of cousin, the word cousin that's used often, that Bolingbroke is in fact a cousin, as is O'Merle, we are all cousins. And this idea of these kids playing, even though they weren't necessarily the same ages, that there was this, as children, they would have
played together. And so because this boy aspect keeps coming back to me with Richard, of when, of him being like, there's a childlike quality to him, that at the moments when it's all going horribly wrong, that the, when I look into Andy Buchan, who plays Bolingbroke's eyes, we tried to remember this idea that as kids we had played with give my toy back or give my, you know, or what that is. And, but now that the stakes are so much higher, but when they see into each other's eyes, it goes back that far into a sort of place of you know, when two people's lives have gone in completely... Yeah.
Well, they're obviously contrasting characters, but do you see them a little bit reflecting each other as well?
Yes, I think so. I think there's... I think that each of them have other qualities that the others have. There's a scene a bit early on in the piece in which Bolingbroke talks in the first scene about, he talks about how, oh gosh, I'm going to completely misquote it, but he does a sort of lovely metaphor about the colour of the sky versus the clarity of how evil things look. And it really makes me laugh when he does it, or Richard finds it funny because, like, oh, you're trying metaphor, are you? You know, so like, you know, it's like, so, which is something that, of course, Richard is, yes, can really deal with. But I also think there's this wonderful thing that with the gauges being thrown in the first scene, and Richard is trying to keep a calm, but doesn't know how to deal with, ends up having this sort of hissy fit at the end of the scene. But you juxtapose that with the later scene in which all those gauges are thrown in front of Bolingbroke and he just picks them up. And it's sort of, you know, and it's, I think that's a great contrast in their capacity to rule.
That was interesting. You said you thought that somewhere inside him he was actually, he'd liked the idea of giving up the crown from quite early on. So in the scene where he's taking it back and giving it and has he planned that? Is he seeing what he's giving up? Or is it inevitable, of course, really, isn't it?
I think it's what...
Or is he just enjoying acting?
I mean, I think there's a lot of that as well.
He loves being the centre of attention.
But I think the most interesting thing about it is that Bolingbroke never asks for the crown straight off. I mean, the first thing, when I come down, down I come, like Glistering Fair, and he comes down, and Bolingbroke says, "I come but for mine own." And Richard goes, "Your own is yours, and I am yours, and all." And he gives it away. Bolingbroke said, "I've come for my own." He goes, "Well, okay." But then it's this idea that then gets recapitulated later in the speech in the prison, in which he goes, "You know, sometimes my king, then treason makes me wish myself a beggar. So sometimes I just want to be a normal man or a poor man every day." And then crushing penury persuades me I was better when a king. Actually, I need that wealth. And I love that because I think that is incredibly human, isn't it?
Yes. So a couple of times he mentions that he too needs friends, which is rather touching.
I mean, I think that's what actually Ian McKellen came and saw the play and he said that of course is the thing, is that he needs friends and he doesn't. I mean, his relationship with himself, with God, with you know, he's better at talking to himself and communicating with God than he is really with communicating to people around him. I mean, sort of Omer plays a figure that who will listen to him, and in Michael's our production, you know, that Omer coming as the keeper at the end, as his groomsman, sort of affirms that relationship. But it's a sort of desperately sad, sort of isolated figure through circumstance. And again, what's so weird about him is he has this capacity to be in the moment and inside, you know, talking to a room, whilst also detach himself instantly and look down on himself. He's almost got two minds working simultaneously.
Well, in scenes where he almost indulges in his self-pity, I mean, like when he comes back from Ireland, he seems to be almost enjoying that. I mean, he knows that he can make an impression by doing this. It is like being in theatre, isn't it?
It is. I think it is. And I think that this idea that, you know, the subconscious will of it to go, exactly, but the subconscious sort of willing it to go comes right from that first line in which he goes,
you know, he's at the beginning of the play, he's got this huge crisis to deal with, that people are coming to have a discussion about Gloucester's death, mm-hmm. and which he has been a part of, and it's about to be a public, in a public forum, and he goes, old John of Gaunt, time-honoured Lancaster, hast thou, according to thy oathen ban, brought hither Henry Hereford, thy bold son, here to make good the boisterous late appeal which then our leisure would not let us hear against the Duke of Norfolk? So this idea that he's known about this, they've been trying to have this discussion in front of him forever, and he's going, but then my leisure wouldn't let us see it. It's nothing to do with this. It's because he's terrified about how to deal with it. So, and he knows that this is a massive moment in his his kingship. So I think that even then he's sort of from the outset going, I realise I've come a cropper here, and I don't know how to...
Although he knows he can't let either of them win, so he does come to a sort of conclusion about that. In exiling them,
but then the sort of, you know, he has to exile Mowbray, who I always think he's had a close relationship with forever, mm-hmm. and this, the horrible moments in which Mowbray, in which Bolingbroke, just as they're being exiled, goes, well, no, tell, given that you're being exiled, tell the truth, and these horrible moments for Richard, in which he's going, oh my God, is he going to tell the truth? You know, yeah. He has to exile Mowbray forever because he is the one who retains the knowledge. Like he knows who is a culprit, and
yes, you're right. It's a really hard place for you to start. It does revealing the character of this.
Yeah, one, it is, because then I mean I find it interesting because I know that some people go, oh, you seem a bit nervous, and you know, and of course as an actor, then you're like, oh no, I hope I'm not looking like a nervous actor, uncomfortable in playing king. Actually, he is a nervous man, and uncomfortable in playing king. But
yeah, because meanwhile, of course, it's also one of the times in the play which is very medieval and ritualistic, and you know, because
yes, and people have expectations of kingship, yes, and what it should be, and I feel like it's probably been done in the past of him seemingly showing yes. to be very competent in those situations, but it's not for me. It's a sort of untruth that this story starts with a king in crisis already, and it's not, he's not ignorant, he's not stupid, it's not like this is all happening underneath him and he's doing it on a whim just because he feels like he's absolutely trying to appear a calm veneer underneath. He's kind of like a sort of duck just paddling away.
Well, then of course he stops being king, and he's much easier for people to like, isn't he, although by then he's isolated, of course, but for the audience it's much easier to respond to him as a human being, and the last, and he does die very well, doesn't he? He's very brave, really.
Well, I feel like if he starts, and if it is this notion of a fall of man, from if we start in our production with this sort of like almost deity image, and then it's down to a man, a beggar being murdered, and the last thing, and so his notion of divine right of monarchy must have been whatever's changed in that throughout the play. The last thing, go, mount my soul, thy seat is up on high. Like your soul, I know my soul does deserve to go to heaven. You know, it's sort of...
But he does describe himself as Christ-like a couple of times as well.
I mean, I think he uses all the imagery that he can. He certainly relates... keeps bringing it back to Judas and to those people around him, and Pilate, and washing your hands, and but his mind is not... What I love about him is he's a completely imperfect man, and not one that his thoughts aren't consistent either. There's a wonderful sort of, which I found terrifying to begin with when I first started the part, actually, was trying to find a through line through it. But actually then when you realise that this is a man, a desperate man, trying to deal with different circumstances.
Well, you found it, I suppose, in that, you know, falling from godlike position to a beggar, from light to dark as well.
And I think that, I mean,
and then finding himself, really, because that is when he really finds himself.
Yes, yes. But even, I mean, that's when he finds himself is when he makes the sort of extraordinarily human observation that with nothing shall be pleased till we be eased with being nothing, and that's basically he realised that all this worrying is, you know, you can't get any gain or enjoyment for life without the understanding that you're going to end up.
The line about Barbary, of course, is always very touching, isn't it? His horse.
His poor horse. The first thing I did was buy found this postcard. It was a drawing of a very beautiful sign. So I showed it to Ashley, who plays. So we had our sort of bonded over what the image of our horse was. But it does break my heart, that line. Yeah. Rode he on Barbary, yeah.
Because this man who didn't have many friends did love his horse.
I know. Better and relationships with exactly yes, with and horses now, and gods.
And now the horse doesn't realise and he's being ridden by Bolingbroke.
Yeah.
And then come the Wars of the Roses before
there
too
go.
Long.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, before you do that, good luck with Marius.
Thank you so much.
And thank you very much indeed for talking
to us. No, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.